You're saying, no, state, there are two kinds of marriages, the full marriage and then the sort of skim milk marriage.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. That was Justice Ginsburg yesterday. Will the same-sex couples soon enjoy benefits of full marriage and not just what she calls skim milk marriage under the Defense of Marriage Act? Yesterday's Supreme Court hearing suggests that DOMA may not survive this legal challenge. Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon joins us now to help analyze the arguments. You can catch her right here on Saturday mornings as well on Slate's GabFest Radio. We're going to take a listen to the arguments yesterday, and later she's going to take your calls on just what might come when we get rulings on these two cases from this week. Emily Bazelon, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
So out of the arguments yesterday, there seemed nearly universal consensus that DOMA was in trouble. Why are court watchers so confident?
Well, it wasn't that the court was universal. It was that everybody was looking to Justice Kennedy. He's the swing vote here, and he seemed very uncomfortable with the main argument for keeping DOMA, this part of DOMA, I should say, that the lawyer Paul Clement was making. So what we're talking about here is the definition in DOMA of marriage as a union between a man and a woman. And Clement kept saying that this is all about uniformity. The federal government has to treat gay couples in New York, where gay marriage is legal, the same as gay couples in Oklahoma, why it's not. But that was it. And as Kennedy said, it's not really that plausible to think that the real reason Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Act was simply uniformity.
So let's take a listen to some of those arguments on that exchange on uniformity. Justice Kagan honed in right on that. Let's take a listen.
Mr. Clement, for the most part and historically, the only uniformity that the federal government has pursued is that it's uniformly recognized the marriages that are recognized by the state. So this was a real difference in the uniformity that the federal government was pursuing. And it suggests that maybe Congress had something different in mind than uniformity. So we have a whole series of cases which suggest the following, which suggests that when Congress targets a group that is not everybody's favorite group in the world, that we look at those cases with some, even if they're not suspect, with some rigor to say, do we really think that Congress was doing this for uniformity reasons, or do we think that Congress's judgment was infected by dislike, by fear, by animus, and so forth? I guess the question that this statute raises, this statute that does something that's really never been done before, is whether that sends up a pretty good red flag that that's what was going on.
That's Justice Elena Kagan. Then Mr. Clement responded by saying that the lawmakers in 1996, when DOMA was passed, had to choose between uniformity and states' rights. Here's what he said.
When you look at Congress doing something that is unusual, that deviates from the way they've proceeded in the past, you have to ask, well, was there a good reason? And in a sense, you have to understand that in 1996, something's happening that is, in a sense, forcing Congress to choose between its historic practice of deferring to the states and its historic practice of preferring uniformity. Up until 1996, it essentially has it both ways. Every state has the traditional definition. Congress knows that's the definition that's embedded in every federal law. It says, fine, we can defer. Okay, 1996.
Well, is what happened in 1996, and I'm going to quote from the House report here, is that Congress decided to reflect and honor a collective moral judgment and to express moral disapproval of homosexuality. Is that what happened in 1996?
Does the House report say that? Of course the House report says that. And if that's enough to invalidate the statute, then you should invalidate the statute. But that's never been your approach, especially under rational basis or even rational basis plus, if that's what you're suggesting.
Interesting exchange there. How much do the original intentions of lawmakers matter? When you heard that, what do you think?
I think they matter a great deal, because for Kagan to show that the House really was expressing moral disapproval is to move into this territory that the government was really trying in some way to condemn or express displeasure toward a particular minority. And in a couple of cases, Justice Kennedy has suggested that that is not a valid basis for passing a law.
And so there was also this pushback in the arguments yesterday that the idea of gay citizens had also gained so much political power that this was something that was happening and the court didn't really need to get involved. Let's take a listen to Chief Justice Roberts speaking with Edith Windsor's lawyer, Roberta Kaplan.
I suppose the sea change has a lot to do with the political force and effectiveness of people representing, supporting your side of the case?
I disagree with that, Mr. Chief Justice. I think the sea change has to do, just as was discussed in Bowers and Lawrence, with an understanding that there is no difference, there is no fundamental difference that could justify this kind of categorical discrimination between gay couples.
You don't doubt that the lobby supporting the enactment of same-sex marriage laws in different states is politically powerful, do you?
With respect to that categorization of the term for purposes of heightened scrutiny, I would, Your Honor. I don't —
Really?
Yes.
As far as I can tell, political figures are falling over themselves to endorse your side of the case.
The fact of the matter is, Mr. Chief Justice, is that no other group in recent history has been subjected to popular referenda to take away rights that have already been given or exclude those rights the way gay people have.
So why does this matter, whether the lobby behind gay marriage is politically powerful from a constitutional and a civil rights point of view?
So this is like the rear guard action that Chief Justice Roberts was fighting on behalf of conservatives. The bigger issue in this case, the kind of larger gain for gay people that could come out of it, is the judicial standard called heightened scrutiny. And that's the idea that when courts look at laws that treat groups of people differently, in particular women, sex discrimination cases, they take a closer look. They use heightened scrutiny. Gay people have never gotten the benefit of heightened scrutiny before as a group. And so, but in this case, the court could say, you know what? Because of historical discrimination and their lack of political power relative to the majority, we need to start thinking about discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation the way we think about discrimination on the basis of sex and also race and religion and ethnicity. And so you can see here Roberts trying to get the lawyer for Edie Windsor to concede, oh no, gay people are super powerful, as a way of heading that off. I don't know what will happen with the heightened scrutiny standard, but I think that Roberts was really betraying here his frustration that he may be on the losing side of this case.
And just what did you make of the way that he described that political figures falling over themselves to endorse gay marriage? That's not quite how I would characterize the status quo in America right now.
No, of course not. I mean, we have only 9 states out of 50 that have fully legalized gay marriage. This past election was the first time that gay rights proponents won at the ballot box in terms of getting marriage initiatives passed. And so the idea that they are so super powerful and entrenched as a lobbying group is a made-up one, I think.
So we've heard Justice Ginsburg talking about skim milk marriage. We heard that exchange with Justice Kagan. And then there's Chief Justice Roberts kind of setting forth what you think will be the losing side on this argument. The swing vote, of course, could come down to Justice Kennedy. Let's take a listen into what he was concerned about. Here he is in an exchange with Paul Clement.
The federal government has sort of 2 sets of authorities that give it sort of a legitimate interest to wade into this debate. Now, one is whatever authority gives rise to the underlying statute. The second and complementary authority is that, you know, the federal government recognizes that it's a big player in the world, that it has a lot of programs that might give states incentives to change the rules one way or another. And the best way, one way to stay out of the debate and let just the states develop this and let the democratic process deal with this is to just say, look, we're going to stick with what we've always had, which is traditional definition. We're not going to create a regime that gives people an incentive and point to federal law and say, well, another reason you should have same-sex marriage is because then you'll get estate tax deductions. They just stayed out of it.
But I see an illogic in your argument. I hadn't thought of the relation between Section 2 and Section 3 in the way you just said. You said, now, Section 2 was in order to help the states. The Congress wanted to help the states. But then in Section 3, the Congress doesn't help the states, which have come to the conclusion that gay marriage is lawful. So that's inconsistent.
No, they treat them which is to say they are preserving, they are helping the states in the sense of having each sovereign make this decision.
We're helping the states do if they do what we want them to, which is not consistent with the historic commitment of marriage and of questions of the rights of children to the state.
So what do you hear Justice Kennedy saying there about how he views states' rights in relation to same-sex marriage?
So this is a little complicated. We're talking about Section 2 and Section 3 of DOMA. One part of it is this blanket definition of marriage as the union of a man and a woman for the whole country. The other part of DOMA says that the states don't have to recognize gay marriage rights under what's called the full faith and credit clause in the Constitution, where usually states recognize each other's laws. And so Kennedy's saying, like, okay, I get, Congress, that you were letting anti-gay marriage states off the hook of recognizing pro-gay marriage state laws, but I don't understand why in creating this universal definition you are taking away from states the federal benefits that would go along with their state laws. And this is Kennedy wrestling with what I think he sees as an intrusion of federal power into the state prerogative to define marriage. So he's saying, look, in states that are allowing gay marriage and helping children by having their parents get married, this was a big point that came up in Tuesday's argument about the California gay marriage ban from Kennedy. He's worried about these kids. He's saying, look, why are you, federal government, interfering with the state's efforts to protect these kids and these families? And that, I think, really undermines the argument that Clement was trying to make here in support of DOMA.
So we have the supporters of DOMA who are arguing that this is needed for uniformity. We have Justice Kennedy saying, I'm concerned that this is undermining the state's prerogative to decide who they want to allow to get married. Is there any precedent in the high court for saying we want to respect states' rights, but then when you look at things like how on earth would we deal with Social Security benefits with couples who are married in New York for 20 years and then move to North Carolina 5 years later, and how the federal government can deal with that? Is there any sort of, when the court has said states' rights matter, but in the interest of being able to administer federal benefits, the uniformity argument could win out?
So here's the thing. Those people who get married in New York and move to North Carolina, they are the next case. This case is about the people who get married in New York and live in New York. And so if they get federal benefits, that's an incremental step. It doesn't give federal benefits to gay couples all over the country. It doesn't recognize gay marriage all over the country. It's just this one step. And then you build on that step. That's the litigation strategy of the gay rights movement here. And it was very carefully thought through. And I think what you see, particularly in listening to Kennedy, is there's an alignment here of states' rights and gay people's rights. And those are two things Kennedy is fond of. So that's why this case is perfectly teed up for him.
And just kind of unexpected. Usually when you hear of states' rights, it's not, you don't think, oh, that's gay people's rights. You think states' rights and things like the Civil War.
Exactly. And the South's recalcitrance to recognize the rights of African Americans. That is true. However, states can do progressive or not progressive things, right? I mean, I do think one thing that's important here to remember is that underlying this is an equality argument, right? I mean, we're still having the end goal, and we should still care a lot about whether gay people deserve the right to marriage because they deserve the right to equal protection under the laws. And so there is one way in which this whole argument about states and federalism kind of muffles that message. So I just want to kind of bring that out.
And if the four justices who would vote along with Kennedy in 5-4 to strike down DOMA, if they have to align themselves with his states' rights argument, does that undercut the sort of force of the movement to make a sort of broader argument about equality?
It could, but I think there'll be another part of this opinion, and it's going to say, look, we just don't buy the notion that Congress only cared about uniformity. We think there was also an expression of moral disapproval here. See House report. And that, I think, will be more helpful in sending the message and having a ruling that says, look, it is not okay to discriminate against gay people legally because, you know, we don't approve of their conduct. And I honestly think the most interesting thing to me about these 2 days of argument was how reluctant the conservatives on the court and the conservative lawyers were to really make an argument that expressed bigotry. There was a lot of tiptoeing around the real basis for these laws, and a sense that in 1996, when DOMA was passed, I think Congress certainly was expressing prejudice against gay people, that maybe that moment is past. The country has moved on from a lot of that prejudice. And I think the lawyers even conceded, you know, this is all about hitting the pause button. They weren't saying that this change is not going to happen, just that it's happening too quickly for them.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer today. I'm speaking to Slate's Emily Bazelon about the arguments at the Supreme Court this week on same-sex marriage. After the break, we're going to take your questions. There's been a lot covered over the last couple of days, and what could happen when the court rules. If you have questions, call in 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or if you just have impressions about what it's been like to listen in as this the country's high court has weighed same-sex marriage and what the definition of family is. We'll take your questions after the break. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. Today, we are listening back to the Supreme Court's arguments about DOMA and same-sex marriage yesterday, and also just trying to get a sense of what we could be facing when the court rules later in the summer. Emily Bazelon is here from Slate. And before we take your calls, one quick note that I want to make sure we also include is looking at DOMA again in this strange manner in the way it got to the Supreme Court, and the question of should the president be defending federal law. That's what Justice Scalia honed in on in a question, and he was pretty uncomfortable with the precedent of the president being able to dictate that he thought a law was unconstitutional before the court had ruled on that question. Let's take a listen to this long clip.
It has not arisen very often in the past, because in the past, when I was at the Office of Legal Counsel, there was an opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel, which says that the Attorney General will defend the laws of the United States, except in two circumstances. Number one, where the basis for the alleged unconstitutionality has to do with presidential powers. When the presidential powers are involved, he's the lawyer for the president, so he can say, we think the statute's unconstitutional, I won't defend it. The second situation is where no possible rational argument could be made in defense of it. Now, neither of those situations exists here. And I'm wondering if we're living in this new world where the Attorney General can simply decide, it's unconstitutional, but it's not so unconstitutional that I'm not willing to enforce it. If we're in this new world, I don't want these cases like this to come before this court all the time. And I think they will come all the time if that's the new regime in the Justice Department that we're dealing with.
So, Emily Bazelon, how does that matter in terms of the decisions we're going to see, this question that Justice Scalia is bringing up, the question of whether the Obama administration was correct in not enforcing this law and saying we're not going to defend it in the court? Is that going to show up in any of the decisions?
I don't think it's going to be the grounds that the ruling happens on. In other words, I don't think the court is going to toss this case for what's called lack of standing, meaning that the president can't be there because he's sort of on both sides of this issue. However, Justice Scalia has his finger on an oddity of this case, which is that the Obama administration decided along the way that they think DOMA is unconstitutional, but they are still enforcing it, which means in this case, here's Edie Windsor. Her spouse died. She had to pay over $360,000 in inheritance taxes. And even though the government thinks the reason for that is unconstitutional, they haven't given her money back. So there is something odd going on here. I just don't think it's going to be the basis for the ruling. I think the court will figure out some way to deal with it and move on to what's called the merits.
The merits. We will hear how they decide on the merits sometime in late June, correct? Is that when it's
Yes. expected? I mean, one never knows for sure, but that is the plan. Yes.
Okay. So up until we're going to have to sit with these questions for a couple of months, folks. So what do you need to know right now as the court deliberates? We're taking your calls 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Anything that stuck out for you about the arguments they didn't quite understand, something that what the possible implications might be, call in, and Emily Bazelon is here to answer your questions. 212-433-9692. 9692. Donna in Brooklyn, what's your question about what this might mean?
Well, my question regards the actual equality aspect of marriage equality. If DOMA is repealed, does that mean that a gay marriage, say in New York, will be recognized in Oklahoma? Because right now, straight marriages are recognized all over, but I haven't heard anybody talk about that aspect of states' rights.
So that's a really good question. The answer is that we don't know the answer yet. So in other words, there probably won't be anything that comes directly out of this case that would force Oklahoma to recognize a gay marriage in New York. That will be a later challenge. But this particular case, because it's only about the part of DOMA that defines marriage for federal benefits purposes, doesn't address whether states have to recognize gay marriages performed elsewhere.
But there could be, because DOMA also has express language about a federal definition of marriage, if DOMA is struck down on the grounds that it was Congress making a collective moral judgment, does that mean that a couple that marries in New York and moves back to Oklahoma could be federally recognized as married?
So that will be the next question. Do those federal benefits go with that couple? And people will right away start litigating that question to answer it.
And as far as... Because there were two cases this week. We were talking about DOMA today, which were the arguments yesterday. The day before that, there was the Prop 8 case coming out of California. So there is still the possibility that the high court could say, this is discrimination, the law of the land now, it's unconstitutional in the United States of America to say that same-sex couples cannot marry.
Yes, that's true. The California case makes the fundamental equal protection argument that gay people deserve the same rights to marriage throughout the entire country that straight couples have. And it is possible the court would issue that kind of sweeping ruling. I doubt it because I just don't think the court has the appetite for settling this question all the way across the country at a time when it's still being debated, when 41 states have gay marriage bans. That might feel to the court like a premature move to make, even if they were inclined to go in that direction out of their own sense of the importance of gay rights.
David in East Brunswick, New Jersey, what's your question?
Well, I'm just confused because I don't understand why this is being argued for and polygamy, all of us, you know, is not being argued for in the same breath. I mean, I'm not necessarily for polygamy, but I'm just trying to figure out what's the difference. And then if there was really, I think it seems to be a way to legislate morality, because if that wasn't the case, the whole argument would be about civil unions, clarified civil unions.
So that's a good question, Emily. If even the lawyers defending DOMA didn't expressly say this was Congress making a moral judgment about what is marriage in the United States of America, does that open up questions about where the line is where you can say this is what marriage is and this is what marriage isn't?
Not really. And the reason is this. What's at issue here is the idea of harm. You know, what kind of reasonable basis does Congress have to discriminate against gay people not getting married? What harm does gay marriage do? And those arguments have really fallen apart. So we used to have this idea that the children of gay couples would be worse off, that it was bad for them to be in these households. We know now from study after study that that's just not the case. Polygamy, however, there are still some really viable and strong arguments that it perpetuates domestic violence, that kids in those relationships are more likely to be abused. And so as long as there's a clear harm the government can point to that it's preventing, it will still be able to make polygamy illegal.
Felice in Manhattan, what's your question?
Hi. It's not really a question, but I wonder why people who are married get preferential treatment over people who are single. I mean, I was thinking, gee, I could just get a friend or, you know, meet someone who's 64 and say I'm married to them and get their Social Security benefits, or, you know, get someone who works at a corporation who has health insurance and say I'm married to them and get health insurance. So I think people's objection is really about the financial benefits that come with that type of union. And I think it's very hard to differentiate. I certainly know people who are in committed gay relationships. They absolutely deserve the rights that other married couples get. But I guess my issue is really, why are single people being discriminated against? Why can't, you know, like bringing a date to a wedding, why can't people pick one significant other and assign their benefits.
So the DOMA case certainly did put a spotlight on the more than 1,000 federal benefits that take into account your marital status. Did that come up at all before the court, just the question of the state's interest and the federal government's interest in figuring out what kind of rights you get and privileges you get as a citizen based on your marital status?
Well, the parties in this case are all pushing the notion that marriage is super important, so it didn't come up directly. But I think your caller is raising this profound, deep question about why, as a society, we value marriage. And I think what the government would say is that it promotes stability. It's good for kids to be in households where people are married because those relationships are more likely to last. And that's why we're throwing lots of benefits the way of married couples, to give them an incentive to stay married. I do think, though, that one of the ironies of the marriage equality movement is that gay couples used to stand more often for a kind of alternative where you didn't necessarily have to get married, and getting married maybe isn't such a great thing. Maybe it's not for everyone. And in some ways now there's this conformity going on where marriage seems like more of the answer for everyone as opposed to something that's just one of several options for people as they live their lives.
I wonder, just listening in on the arguments over the last couple of days, what struck you as maybe some unintended consequences of what might come about based on how the court decides and how this ended up being framed?
Well, I think that the DOMA case was so expertly framed, I'm not worried about unintended consequences. I'm just excited to see the progress toward gay marriage that I think that case will make. It is possible that if the court went for a 50-state ruling and declared gay marriage across the land, that there could be a political backlash, and that would be, in the end, something that would not be good for the gay rights movement. You know, we've seen that happen in the wake of Roe versus Wade. Abortion became a more divisive rather than less divisive issue. So that's a possible unintended consequence. I just don't personally think that the court wants to go there.
Sue Yang in Brooklyn, you have a question after this week?
Hi. Well, that was basically my question. I mean, I don't understand how the Supreme Court can, you know, I mean, I don't think they're going to institutionalize gay marriage in all 50 states, but how can we have a system where some people are married in some places and some people are not? I mean, you know, we have that mess in California right now. The gay couples that got married during that brief period in which they were allowed to, they will always be considered married in that state regardless of what happens, whereas other gay couples that want to get married will not. So you have this mixed system with all sorts of different kinds of, you know, marriages, and we can't have that. We should have a uniform system for the whole country.
Emily, I have a question about that. I mean, there is some precedence for states having different rules about who can get married and who can't. And prior to 1967, states had rules against interracial marriage. There were criminal codes against interracial marriage. How did that work prior to the court ruling on that, where Loving v. Virginia, the Loving couple went to Washington, D.C., got married, went back to Virginia, and there was an arrest? Did the federal government see them in that moment as married prior to 1967?
I think the federal government did not, although I'm not entirely sure. But you're right. It is messy when we have a patchwork of state laws about anything, in particular about marriage, because people do move. And then what if you need to get divorced in Virginia when you got married legally in Vermont? So it's true that it's messy. But, you know, the chances are it will be messy for some number of years. And in the end, we will have gay marriage everywhere in the United States, because that is where public opinion is moving. And because truly gay marriage brings a lot of benefit to society and poses no harm. And so I think as more and more people see that happen, this issue is going to go away, and we will have some number of years with this mess the way we did before the Supreme Court made interracial marriage legal throughout the country. But I don't think it's going to last for that long.
So we have this patchwork of state laws. We also have immigration laws that the federal government weighs in on based on marital status. Mariana in Ithaca, what's your question about that?
Hi, my question brings in another issue, and it is whether these federal benefits that are in discussion right now include immigration benefits for same-sex partners, whether a same-sex union would then be able to get a green card for a foreign citizen that is married to a U.S. citizen.
Yes, I think that that is on the table. And the Obama administration has taken some steps on its own towards that. They have said that they're no longer looking for people to deport if they're in a long-term committed gay relationship. So there's been some movement. And yes, I do expect that we will see more if the court strikes down this part of DOMA.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there for now. Slate's senior editor, Emily Bazelon, thank you so much for joining with us and listening to this tape and answering our questions. She has a new book out called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. And again, you can hear her on GabFest Radio Saturday mornings at 7 right here on WNYC. Emily, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Anna. Thanks.
Sure. And after the break, we're going to talk about the New York City mayor's race and gender and hot tempers.